Welcome to Worst Year Ever, a production of iHeartRadio.
Welcome to the worst year ever. We'll get through it together or not. Everything is so dumb, 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 dumb.
Hello, welcome back to Worst Year Ever. It really is the worst year
is
ever,
it?
Guys.
What?
Well, in my limited experience, I'll admit that it is the worst year ever. I'm Katie, by the way.
Hi, I'm Cody. Hi. Is my name?
Yep.
It's different from yours slightly.
Robert. And
yeah.
Hello.
Hi.
You know. Hi.
A year of doing this, and you'd think we'd be quicker with this part.
No, I think that was my best introduction yet.
Yeah,
let's just run and print that motherfucker.
We're only getting better.
Do we print things on in audio?
Can you
print that? Okay, well, print it anyway, please.
You did
all right.
Great.
What did you do?
Who are we? What are we doing today?
Today, we are very, very excited to welcome Ryder. Twitter inspiration, Talia Levin.
Twinspiration. No, that's when you're inspired by twins. The mm-hmm. Twitinspiration.
Hey, Talia.
Twit. Just general twit. Me, Talia Levin.
Well, that's
author.
Mean. I don't think we can allow you to be on and insulting our guest.
A newly published author, Talia Levin. That's
congratulations.
Me.
Yeah. That's always an exciting moment.
Yeah. Right. Well, I'm not jaded. This is my first time. And I hope it's as good for you as it is for me.
So far,
it's pretty
great.
I mean, you're making a joke there, but I can confirm that, like, as a writer, that when that book hits, it is a little bit, you know. It's the intellectual equivalent of an orgasm, getting your book out there.
Getting it out there.
It's
a real long build.
Yeah.
It's 288 pages, baby. I put a lot of my life, soul, and sanity into making this book.
And what's your book about?
So it's called Culture Warlords,
My Journey
into the Dark Web of White Supremacy. I didn't make that subtitle, but like it is fairly accurate. It's kind of about the metastasis of the white power movement online and what that looks like, and the different spaces that these ghouls gather and what they talk about when they think no one's listening.
Very, very, very appropriate for our show and for this moment of time we're all currently living through.
Depressingly timely. I really wish that like it was being released, like it was like a quaint topic, like I'd written about like beehives or soup or something. Like, oh, white supremacists, that's not an issue, but it is.
Yeah.
I do think the good thing about our audience is we've been yelling about this for a while, so I think folks are prepared on the basic stuff. I'm kind of interested, if you wouldn't mind, starting off with kind of walking through your own personal story here, your kind of journey into covering this stuff. Because you've got an interesting one, and in fact, our other guest of the pod, Ken Klippenstein, has been putting out some very interesting articles about what happened with you.
I mean, it was sort of. I know, right? It's like cross pollination, the Talia X Ken joint. No, so what happened was in 2018, I was a fact checker at the New Yorker, and ICE put out this tweet, ICE, like Immigration and Customs Enforcement, put out a picture of one of their agents for like an ad. You know, they're always kind of portraying how they're like busting cyber crimes against children, and that's definitely primarily what they do, which is kind of not, I mean, I think they do that to a degree, but it's not what they're known for. And I noticed, I was not the first to notice by a long margin. There were like a lot of people talking about the fact that he had a tattoo on his elbow that looked a bit like an iron cross, which is like, you know, it's a symbol associated with Germany. It's not always a Nazi symbol. It is often a Nazi symbol.
Yeah, and it was essentially like the German Medal of Honor, and then Hitler won one, and it really got kind of tainted by the fact that all the Nazis started putting it on stuff.
So this was floating around the Twitter sphere and people were talking about it pretty emphatically, like, this is the Gestapo, blah, blah, blah. Look at this Nazi. And I was like much more cautious and kind of put up just a photo of the guy that I put up, like a tweet that had like three photos. Like, it was like the ad zeroing in on the guy's elbow and then like a photo of an iron cross with an explanation of what that is. And then a couple of people responded like, oh, maybe it's a Maltese cross. Like, we don't really know. And so I deleted my tweet and posted kind of a correction 15 minutes later, literally 15. Like, this might be a Maltese cross. Deleted my tweet so as not to spread misinformation. I was very self-congratulatory about it. Like, oh, I'm not going to spread disinfo for likes. And then, and like, also, you know, just it was really going around the whole internet, leftist Twitter in 2018 or whatever. And then the following day, like, completely to my shock, ICE put out a press release to like its bajillion followers blaming me directly for starting this rumor, saying that I'd put their agent at risk and, you know, like specifically calling me out and the New Yorker by name, which was crazy and like totally like, it was like for a tweet that had existed for 15 minutes and didn't even have any words in it or like make any definitive statements, just like, could this resemble an iron cross? Maybe. And so that's how I got, and then like the full force of the entire right-wing media like descended on me. It was crazy. It was like the roof was just peeled off my life. And like, I watched this story go from the National Review to the Daily Stormer in, you know, a couple of days. Like, so it was, you know, started with relatively decorous questions to my employer who distanced themselves from me. I was also fact-checking a story.
Heroically
about,
distanced themselves from you.
Yeah, they were like, oh, you know, we're not responsible. And, you know, this derogatory statement, blah, blah, blah. And I, like, was also fact-checking a story about Milo Yiannopoulos at the time. So needless to say, he, like, very gleefully jumped on this and was like, she's a godforsaken wretch, and like leaked my phone number to his fans. Then it winds up in the Daily Stormer where, you know, it's like the, you know, the lovely Nazi writer.
Yeah,
there.
It's the New Yorker of racism.
Yeah. like a few, like same amount of umlauts, but they're mostly about Nazi terms. But you know, it was like, she's the reason why there should be a real Holocaust. Like, this collection of soap ingredients, blah, blah, blah.
This sounds like a real nightmare.
Yeah, it was fucking terrible. I, like, really had a rough week. A lot of, like, suicidal ideation and self-harm and just, like, bad vibes all around. And I was, like, a very company woman at the time, really believed in The New Yorker and didn't want my colleagues to catch flack. And so I resigned. And it was, like, really bad. And then I had already written about the far right once. I had written about how hard it was for the Daily Stormer to find a web host after Unite the Right in Charlottesville, and compared them to the Wandering Jews, which they really hated.
Yeah, I'm sure they did.
Yeah. And so then after that, I worked at Media Matters as an extremism researcher. So I really spent a lot of time delving deeper and deeper into the crucible of the far right and have been writing about it ever since. So that's the...
A harrowing journey.
Well, it was like the abyss was gazing at me so intensely that I was like, fuck it, I'm going to look at you guys too. Harder.
And
so,
yeah, it's like Nietzsche said, sometimes when the abyss stares at you, you got to like wink it and be like, what's up with you, abyss? How are you doing?
Yeah. Like, hey, abyss, I'm going to dive in and figure out what the fuck you're all about. Because if I'm already being called, you know, the K word every single day. Yeah. And like, you know, having like photos of my feet posted to Nazi chats before I'm like even doing anything
wild,
you know, except writing a few articles, then I might as well
go
write
all
a book
in
about the damn thing.
So you, and that's what you did. I correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, your book is about you going into the different chat, the different online arenas where these people fester, adopting different personas and infiltrating and kind of getting information.
Yeah, I mean, it's because I had this sort of reputation among these people already, you know, because, and then, you know, I kind of doubled down. I'm a very stubborn person and I doubled down and I was writing about the far right and kind of just being like, Nazis bad. That was my general public thesis. And because I'm a woman and because I'm Jewish, like there are identitarian elements of this too. I couldn't sort of go through the front door and I had to do a little more like a combo of sort of OSINT, open source intelligence stuff, and then like the gonzo kind of undercover stuff. So the book is really a mix of like history. I talk a lot about Robert's favorite, George Lincoln Rockwell. I talk about, you know, Henry Ford and the history of anti-Semitism in America and all that stuff. But the sort of juicy parts or whatever are like the various iterations of like undercover ops that I did. So that included posing as like an Aryan babe on an all-white dating site, whitedate.net, and just like getting them to write love letters to their ideal white wife and then publishing them in a book. I spent like 5 months seducing this like Ukrainian neo-Nazi who ran, like stochastic terror channel dedicated to worshiping Brenton Tarrant, the Christchurch mosque shooter, and then like passed his everything he'd given me, which was his name, license plate, job, and like basic area where he lived, to Bellingcat, who published it. So that was pretty satisfying. I pretended to be an incel. I like got into planning chats for like a pagans versus Christians white supremacist MMA fight. Just like fun adventures like that. Definitely give the book a little color. I like basically really went like to and beyond the edge of myself for the book.
I want to talk about all sorts of stuff, the things that you cover in this book and the different topics and themes. But as you're sitting here describing this, I'm curious if you're open to talking about this emotional toll that that must have had for you personally to be going through this. Because as you describe this, to me, it sounds really painful. And like...
Well, yeah. I mean, one of the episodes I describe in the book is like the opening of chapter one, because I like wanted to kind of drive it home. Was like, so there's this organization of neo-Nazis called the Bold Cast that's like particularly grim and like stochastic terror-y. They're named after Dylan Roof's haircut, his bull haircut. And I was like eavesdropping on a chat affiliated with them, and I like open the chat at like 4 a.m. because I totally lost the ability to sleep for most of 2019. And they're discussing, would anyone rape Talia Levin?
Oh my God.
And the most of the consensus was they were that I was too ugly to rape, but one of them said they would rape me with a gun. And everyone agreed that that was the best course of action. So yeah, there were definitely some like really fucked up moments over the course of reporting on this book, where like you become both subject and object of hate. I would say that being a Jew, and like having, you know, a really like the Holocaust is like really close to my family. Yeah. Like my maternal grandparents' entire families died in it. I actually lost an aunt in the Holocaust. Like, you know, my grandparents had a baby and she died while they were on the run in the woods. And so, you know, so my mom lost a sister too. Like, you know, it was really close. And then me being like the object of so much of their ire. Really, I think the advantage it lent me was that I never lost a sense of moral clarity of what was at stake.
Yeah.
You know, I never let it become a collection of shiny objects, although like there's so much that is absurd and fascinating in this world that sometimes you can lose your way into like just cataloging it like it's sort of a collection of sundry oddities. But for me, because I was the locus of so much hate and come from a community that, you know, really become that really is the locus of so much ire, it helped me retain moral clarity. It also definitely chipped away at my sanity in different ways. It was a painful experience, and it really was like living at the edge of tolerability and beyond it.
Yeah, I can't imagine. Yeah, I haven't finished your book yet, but what I have read so far is incredible. incredibly engaging. Your writing is incredibly eloquent and accessible for people who this world might be new to them. I am more well-versed in this whole world than I think the average person, but not as much as, say, Robert or Cody or yourself. And I found it incredibly engaging. Yeah, that was just my compliment insert here because I wanted
well,
you to
thank
know
you.
That
I
that
mean,
really comes through, like all your, you know, all this, that emotional journey that you, that you're talking about. And I was really struck also just growing up here and feeling and hearing all these stories and your, you know, your identity and your whole family, how you came here, and the Holocaust so recently in your past, but feeling like that is separate from being here in America, like anti-Semitism isn't necessarily here. And then, you know, being online and discovering that it's very much, very real here. And it's tied into all of this other stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and that's where like the Jewish sort of assimilation into whiteness plays in, where like, you know, the people who consider us non-white are like white supremacists, you know, and Christians are, mainline Christians are very weird about Jews too. So
yeah, there's
not
a lot of like weird messianic, you know, groups where they're like, they'll call themselves rabbis, but they'll be all about Jesus. Like I keep going to protests where people who are not Jewish have shofars, which is like a horn that has a specific ritual.
Yeah,
purpose,
it's like a ram's horn. We blow it at, you know, New Year and stuff. And yeah, and like Christian
and
Zionism
them,
is a whole other like weird millenarian ideology that like really to a frightening extent influences American foreign policy. So it's not like totally just like the imprimatur of white supremacists to be super weird about Jews, but like white supremacists are weird about Jews in like a particularly violent way. But like it of course is an expression of privilege that it took until adulthood and an internet connection to really feel the like brunt of that sort of prejudice. But I do feel that having that element of my identity constantly sort of under fire like helped me retain a sense of moral clarity as I wrote the book, that there are wages of there are victims in every to allowing far right organizing to flourish. It's not a victimless crime, it's not a perpetratorless crime. It's like there are humans on both ends, humans who suffer and humans who choose to inflict suffering. And I think that's like one of the bigger messages of the book, is that white supremacists aren't, you know, sort of monsters that are inhuman and you know, unique or uniquely poor or uniquely ignorant or uniquely beset by any set of disenfranchising circumstances that render it, you know, understandable. They're just people from every socioeconomic bracket and level of educational attainment and every geographic region.
Mm-hmm.
And making the human choice to live in a world where they want hate to win.
Yeah. Yeah, that stood out to me as well, that where you were saying they're there. They're sitting next to you in class. They're in your office, in your cubicle. And then
and like your nice
night,
your nice HOA neighborhood is not like,
it's not,
you know,
what it
immune.
Seems.
and also that, like, you know, I think some of the most egregious journalism about white nationalists in this era, like that infamous Times profile of Tony Hoviter and like the whole dapper fascist.
Yeah, the Nazi next door. Yeah.
And I'm
he's
like,
a Nazi,
not,
but he dresses well.
Right. And I'm like, it's not shock. It should not be shocking to you that a Nazi can like make pasta without like jizzing a swastika into the pot. Like, you know, that like they're
that he
not,
might have
like,
his garden.
They're not like, you know, like shitting themselves and like Sig Heiling. And, you know, own a house. Like, these are human people with human choices and human lives who make the human choice every single day to inflict pain and cause fear among their targets. And so I thought it was important not to downplay that element. And to me, their humanity doesn't absolve them at all. If anything, it renders them more damned because they have made the human choice to engage in creating a worse world.
Yeah.
I'm just dropping the heavy shit. I don't know.
Like, no, it's great. I mean, it's also just important. We have this like a less so now, but I'd say it's been chipped away over the last 4 years, but a lot of people still don't realize the things that you're saying and that it's everywhere, that it's here, that just because the Holocaust happened and we all decided this was bad, that, you know, collectively on the surface, that there aren't people that harbor these same disgusting ideologies living amongst us and planning and doing things and perpetuating hate every day all around us. And we need to be able to see that. You need to be able to see that happening.
Yeah. And there's this really classist assumption that they're like, it must be poverty. It must be, you know, some unique like socioeconomic deprivation, that it's toothless masturbating Cletus who can barely string two sentences together. And I'm not saying like every white supremacist is, you know, a MacArthur fellow in disguise.
No, the one of them who's killed the most people was capable of constructing a 6,000-pound bomb in a Ryder truck and destroying a federal building with it. Like, because he was smart and capable and knew what he was doing and was like able to plan something very complicated. Like, it's that that's one of the big issues I think that folks have in confronting this, is the assumption that like the most these people are capable of is like kind of random acts of violence, and they're not a real threat. I think when people think about like what a white supremacist or what like a neo-Nazi's goal would be, they assume like, well, they're trying to, you know, bring back the Nazi party or whatever. And that's clearly not going to happen in the United States. But like they're the goals of a lot of these people are a lot are much more kind of insidious than that. Like accelerationism, which I know you want to talk about, is the thing that concerns me the most right now. And it's not trying to, you know, red pill normies into being Nazis as much as it is trying to push society in directions that guarantee the kind of violence that will give them more power and give them more of the things that they want. Like it's and it's working, right? Like one of the things that we're seeing right now this year, and a lot of the work I'm doing, is the people who are planning and threatening terrorist attacks, the people who are getting like arrested for, you know, trying to kidnap and kill governors. A lot more of them, very few of them, are people who traditionally we would consider extremists. They're Trump supporters and police supporters. But in a lot of ways, the fact that these people are being radicalized and are making these kind of plans is a result of kind of the way in which some of these more extreme white nationalist groups have prepared the ground, in not in a series of terrorist attacks and their manipulation of the media. Like they've put our society in this position where radicalism doesn't look the way it used to look.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of that has to do with the fact that Trumpism is a white nationalist movement. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a sort of inherent desire for ethnic cleansing that's been there from the start. But yeah, I agree. I mean, so I have a book and a chapter in the book about accelerationism called Getting to the Boom. So accelerationism is this idea that you know, you want to hasten social collapse. And in the case of the far right, that means basically out of the ashes of society, a white utopia will rise like a phoenix. We'll be able to engage in the kind of ethnic cleansing that we fantasize about. The United States will at last be free of the Jew. You know, it's the stuff that's been around since the Turner Diaries, you know, this fantasy of the day of the rope where every race traitor and Jew will be hung from trees. There are echoes of it in QAnon and like this whole day when everyone will be executed for treason. Like, you know, it's a very resonant idea, and it's certainly resonant on the MAGA right and the extremist right, and the lines between them are blurrier every day. So yeah, I think that when I look at the next 6 weeks, you know, leading up to the election, day of the election, in the aftermath of, you know, God forbid, like a hotly contested election or an unclear election, what I see as a big danger is accelerationist violence. Like this idea of we're already in a moment of civic chaos and now's the time to strike hard. And so, and to your point, Robert, like, I think there's been a lot of skepticism and even skepticism on the left about like, are these guys really a potent force? Mm-hmm. Does it really matter? And I would say, first of all, like how many mass casualty events like premised on racism are okay with you? Like for me, the answer is none. And we've had a number over the past few years. And, you know, it doesn't take that many people to be tipped over by years of stochastic terror into engaging in a mass casualty events to create an environment of profound harm, chaos, loss, fear, and destruction. So, you know, that's what we're potentially facing. And I think while I understand the impulse towards cynicism and, like, you know, many of these people cloak their danger in absurdities, you know, they want you to laugh and feel like to laugh at them or see them as boogeymen in the way that the Klan, like, you know, initially dressed in their white robes to be like, oh, we're just dressing up as ghosts to frighten, you know, black people, don't take us seriously. And then they were out committing murder. Like, you know, yeah. I think there's, we have to take it seriously. And, like, it's not a joke.
Yeah. I would say that maybe I'm not somebody that didn't believe that this stuff would happen, but I've definitely realized more and more, especially this year, the last 4 years, just how the unbelievable, the thing that you think can't happen and that people won't do can happen, then they will do more and more.
Yeah, it's not great, Bob. Bob. None of you are named Bob, but it just...
Robert is pretty close to that.
It's close.
Yeah. I mean, if you don't want me to be angry at you, yes, you can call me.
Isn't
Bob
Evans like a chain of something?
It is, and this is the last that we should say about that.
Sorry,
I'm googling it now.
Mm-hmm. Never meet your heroes because you will offend them horribly.
No, it's just that like the Bob podcast. Evans restaurant has been a constant assault on the pride of my people. My people being other people named Robert Evans, which again only included me and the guy who produced Godfather. There are no others.
Yeah. So accelerationism, it's bad. It's scary.
In a nutshell,
it's bad. It's scary. And it's coming to a town next door.
Welcome to the worst year ever. We'll get through it together.
Interesting to me is the degree to which accelerationism has synergized with something with a number of things that have been part of American culture for quite a long time. Like I'm a big advocate of, and I press this every time people ask me about like the Boogaloo folks, that I know there's some people who will like claim that it started with like, you know, the Rahoa race war sort of like memes and stuff among white supremacists, and some of that played into it. But I think if you're going to trace it to a direct origin point, it's the zombie apocalypse stuff. And it's had all this other, like, syncretism is a big aspect of fascism, and it's had all this other stuff grafted onto it. But it started with this idea of preparing for a collapse that turned from, like, a joke into less of a joke. And because it was becoming less of a joke, people needed to find, like, something more that felt more realistic so that they didn't feel silly that they were spending thousands of dollars and all these guns to fight quote unquote zombies. And I really see a lot of the what we're dealing with now started in places like, and it's not just the zombie apocalypse stuff. There's always been this long running American like theme in American popular culture, this like obsession with the idea of collapse and with social degeneration and the violence that will come with it. Cory Doctorow just wrote a very good article about vaguely this topic for, I think it was Slate, and kind of the complicity that American fiction writers sort of have in some of this. So we've, you know, and I think the Nazis recognized that. I think people like Louis Beam recognized that a while ago, that like there were actually a lot of cultural aspects of the United States that made us particularly vulnerable to this kind of accelerationism. Like it's this idea that if you keep pumping chaos and violence into a culture that is already fairly dominated by chaos and violence, it will push people to become increasingly radical. And, you know, as a Nazi, even if it doesn't push people to be Nazis, because like the Boogaloo folks by and large are not Nazis, they still further those end goals, which is like enough social degeneration and decay and violence that order breaks down and that these heavily armed fascists are able to impose like the order they want. And I don't know.
There is like a Rahawa strain in the Boogaloo movement.
Sure. There's a far right strain. There's Nazis who try to recruit in it and stuff, but like, that's not where it started. They're opportunists. Like the Boogaloo stuff, like I've traced back a lot of the earliest commentary on that, and they were never very far from the Nazis, but it's also like it clearly started as an aesthetic more than anything else.
Yeah, survivalist fetishism, right?
Yeah that all played into it. There's all this, a bunch of stuff played into it.
It's like the dystopia is coming, the collapse is coming, every movie is a disaster movie that is, the world is over, and now here we are, and I think we have slowly not just like assumed that that was going to happen, but like wanted it to happen. Like there's an embracing of that that dystopian world.
Well, it's like once you've like gotten enough equipment that you feel prepared, like surely there is an element that that desires it. Yeah. So, I wanted to, so one of the things I cite in the book, actually on that subject, a very early, an earlier iteration of this idea that like civilizational collapse will inevitably lead to like the fulfillment of Nazi fantasy, is like, there's a chapter in White Power by George Lincoln Rockwell called Nightmare, where he envisions, it's this really ludicrous, like very lurid fantasy where he envisions like the black socialists are taking over America and like they've taken over the armed services and like you are the protagonist. It's this like very like vividly written second person narrative, and like, you know, like all these black men are like taking over and killing people and raping people, and you're sort of the noble American hero. And you watch your neighbor, who's this like white liberal, you know, shoot a black man to death unrepentantly. And it's this idea that like, given sufficient chaos and collapse and like this fictitious imminent black socialist takeover, every white liberal will become, you know, as deeply racist as George Lincoln Rockwell. So, you know, that's an early iteration of the idea that social collapse will be the key to white utopia. And I think you see some of that too in the sort of degree of apocalyptic nature of the rhetoric around this election. This, like, mm-hmm. I mean, we're really talking about people talking about Joe Biden as like bringing in like a Chavez-esque, like,
like he's always promised to do, famed socialist Joseph,
radical
Robinette
socialist
Biden.
Joseph.
Yeah.
That's what the R is for.
Robinette Biden.
Radical.
You can see his speeches in Congress decades ago.
If I were ranking all of the communists.
It's not even just like the usual shit, like they'll take your guns or whatever. I mean, that's always a hot.
Yeah.
Yeah, they'll always
hot,
do that. They're doing it today.
Talking point, but it's like become so apocalyptic. He's a Trojan horse for taking all your rights away. And so it's like, that's one of the things that keys up rhetoric to this pitch. It's like that, you know, we're teetering on the edge of an abyss, and like the outcome of this election will determine like your ability to not literally like be imprisoned in a camp for like saying a racial slur or whatever. Like, it's so, like, the tenor of political conversation is pitched at such an apocalyptic key that I think, you know, you have the militia groups preparing, you have, you know, the neo-Nazis preparing. Yeah. Like, there's just a lot of preparing going on. And, like, that much preparing with that many guns, just, I feel like it just doesn't lead to anywhere good.
Definitely makes me nervous.
Yeah. When, like, the real collapse that could potentially happen is climate change related. So like all these groups are going to be around with all of this stuff and all these guns ready to do these kinds of things, just as the planet slowly deteriorates.
Yeah. Like, we're trapped on this like swiftly warming planet with like the chaos monsters. It's not amazing.
It's not amazing.
That's my general take. I mean, not a fan. Not a fan of the way things are going. Feels like the worst year ever. Except that a part of me, like the real pessimist in me, is like, we're going to look back on 2020 and be like, oh, that that year was so fine. That year
I
was
think
great.
About that because at least every year of the last 4 years, we're like, oh, thank God that year's over. And it doesn't get better, you know? Like,
I saw this great video. Molly Crabapple is a wonderful artist, socialist artist. And like, they did something amazing. It was like a collaboration project with one of the founders of Black Lives Matter of kind of imagining a better future. They used paintings and like they talked about like, you know, how this moment of plague and deprivation and climate devastation like led to the great sort of cooperative utopian future. And it was really meticulously imagined. And I thought that was such an important thing because it's so easy to work yourself into a state where you can't imagine things ever getting better. And that kind of utopia, like that kind of ability to imagine a better future, I think is a sanity saving thing where it's like, you know, there can be hope that there can be change. That it can be for the better. It might be hard to envision right now, but perhaps there will be a year when we look back on 2020 and say that sucked and I'm so glad things are much better now. That would be great. That's my
people
hope.
Have come around, they're changing their minds. Did you see in your travels, I guess is not the right word, indications of people who are like getting into those groups and subcultures who aren't like fully there yet or like are questioning what's going on there and are like that you saw as being able to more easily be pulled back from that abyss, I guess.
Interestingly, the most successful tales of like de-radicalization I've seen are like after people have been doxxed as Nazis.
Oh, yeah.
And like their lives have fallen apart and they're like, this wasn't worth it. Oh, there's mm-hmm. no solidarity here. Mm-hmm. No one gives a shit about me.
Right.
No one's going to come save me. No one's going to help me.
There's no bail fund for Nazis.
Yeah. They don't give a shit about each other. Like, so like, unfortunately, I mean, I didn't meet a lot of edge cases because the places that I was hanging out online were sort of already radicalized. And then I did the major trips I took were to Charlottesville for the anniversary of Unite the Right mm-hmm. to meet like with local anti-fascists. But then I did go to a conference, hosted by Andy Ngo, our favorite.
Great.
And Tim Pool called Minds IRL, which was basically for like fans. Sargon of Akkad was there. It was like for fans of fascist YouTubers. And like they billed it as like, oh, it's like so pluralist because they were going to have a couple of like leftist speakers or like quote unquote leftist speakers willing to speak at an Andy Ngo Tim Pool conference. But I did talk to a lot of people there and it was just like so funny. Like one of the funnier interactions I had, they kept asking like, oh, so this really bills itself as like ideologically diverse. And like, have you met any progressives? And no one said, everyone said no. But one guy was like, well, I met an ethno-nationalist and I'm a civic nationalist. So I really saw a difference of opinion.
There. Diversity of opinions. Cool.
Okay.
But like those were people that like traveled across the country to go see Andy Ngo in person. So
it's the marketplace.
What do you think?
A reachable demographic. I met him. I talked to him. It was funny. He was like, no, you can't photograph me. And, like, isn't your whole thing like shoving phones in people's faces without their consent? But I like covertly filmed him. I was like,
good for you.
Do you provide kill lists to Adam Waffen?
I'm sure he had a lot to.
No comment. Like, you're not even British. You're not British.
You're not. I know.
And then I met Tim Pool and I asked him if he ever washed his beanie. And he said he has like 20.
Does he wash?
I heard that he has many, many. He just has like piles of them.
Yeah. Yeah. That was a funny experience. It was like they'd both done like videos or commentary about how evil I was. And then I like met them in person and they were very polite as they lied to my face. And then, like, Andy Ngo posted that I was shaped like a pigeon.
Oh, fuck him.
He's a real classy act.
Well, I do have a big ass. So in that sense, I suppose I'm shaped like a Pigeon.
Yeah, which is the first thing I think about he's pigeons. Are there luscious butts?
If you look at like his old Reddit history and stuff, he's just a profoundly unpleasant person who is deeply insecure about his own body and mainly attacks people who he thinks fit the idealized version of a human in his head even less than he does. Because he's
really hates fat because he used to be fat. And so as a woman of larger-ness, you become a riper target. I mean, that's always like, what's interesting about being like subject and object, right? In this context is like, you know, looking at their stuff. They are obsessed with fat women. Like fat women are just like way up there in their list of targets. And they're obsessed with like the bodies of women. Like I have posted like one bikini photo in my life, like ages ago on Brighton Beach, and someone used it to impersonate me on 4chan on two different occasions that I had like accidentally posted this bikini photo while like badly posing as me being a journalist on 4chan. And the Daily Stormer ran with it and was like fat kike whale Talia Levin accidentally posts bikini picture on 4chan. I'm like, I didn't. But it's just funny like how your own body becomes the site of like this kind of attack. And then that becomes part of the story you tell.
Yeah. Oh, which is all part of misogyny, which is another aspect of your book and what you'd said you might want to chat about today. All of this.
Yeah, like, I'm really bringing the fun topics. Katie was like, what do you want to talk about? And I'm like, I don't know, accelerationism, misogyny, white supremacy. and she was like, I feel weird hearting this. And I'm like,
I know, they don't give you the option for just a like on Facebook.
I think one of the things that being a woman covering the far right like gives me access to is just like the degree to which misogyny is an animating force. It's like both a means of entree and radicalization. Like it's, you know, for a lot of these people who I call the ideological launderers, like the Tim Pools of this world and like the Stefan Molyneux and the Ben Shapiro's, like a lot of their opening bids are misogyny, like Ghostbusters ruined your childhood. Mm-hmm. There's too many ladies in Marvel movies. And like, you can watch that stuff in a living room or in public and not feel like horribly ashamed. You know, most people don't start out brandishing swastikas unless they're very special. But like, you know, what these videos that almost serve as like a moment of hate for like feminists and women do is like inculcate you in a hate that's like relatively socially acceptable and teach you that like one method of like one sort of ideology towards social progress to with feminism is like actually working against your interests and is like nefariously undermining your place in the world. And then once you have someone inculcated in those two principles, like here's a group that's okay to hate, and here's a means of social progress or like a sort of accepted ethos in the mainstream that's actually working to undermine your place in the world, like then you have sort of someone in the palm of your hand already.
Yeah.
Like then, okay, what about the Jews? What about racial equality? I mean, it's all very connected. It's interconnected algorithmically. And these people all know each other and like guest on each other's videos.
Right.
Yeah. You find a place where your form of hate is safe and accepted. And then you're exposed to all these other ones that, you know.
Like level two.
Yeah.
And then it's like, it's sort of an Ouroboros in a way. Like where misogyny forms a point of entree for people into the white supremacist movement, but also the white supremacist movement itself is deeply misogynistic, not only in like the targets it chooses to attack who are disproportionately women, you know, and women receive sexually violent and like truly atrocious harassment, you know, that's of larger and volume and crueler than men. You know, I've had men who cover the far right tell me, I sort of feel like I have like a Batman versus the Joker relationship with these white supremacists. And I'm like, oh, I don't get to be even like Poison Ivy. I'm just literally the plant Poison Ivy. Like they see me as like a rash. You know, I don't get to be like the worthy opponent because I'm a woman.
Right.
And And that's fine. I'm fine. I'm not looking for like womanifest destiny or like white feminism in this. Like, I demand to be equal in the eyes of white supremacists. But like the other aspect of it is that in the idealized world that white supremacists envision, women are submissive. Women are basically like the breeding sacks of the white future. I mean, it's right there in the 14 words, like the white children. And like, who breeds the white children? It's like women are wombs. And like, of course, that has a broader valence in like a Christian dominionist culture and like, you know, fervidly anti-abortion, forced birth conservative movement. But it is particularly vivid in a 14 words sort of culture. That's a white supremacist slogan. That's it's like we must preserve the future for like ourselves and our white children. I think that's the gist of it.
Oh, it's nauseating.
Yeah, it's like so 14 is like a big white supremacist.
Mm-hmm. We're 14, like, 88.
88 stands for Heil Hitler because H is the eighth letter of the alphabet.
Bunch so 1488
is like a big
so dorky.
Yeah, numerology, right? But you know, the guy who code like who came up with the 14 words was David Lane, who was a member of the neo-Nazi terrorist cell, the Order, like shot a Jew to death, like a Jewish radio host to death, but also like
in Denver.
They like robbed a shit ton of armored cars and like raised millions of dollars for white supremacists.
Yeah, which they used in part to fund Louis Beam starting LibertyNet, which was an early internet in like the mid 1980s just for Nazis and was really the genesis point for everything, you know, we've been talking about today. Like, that's where the Nazi internet effort started. It's
Liberty.
It's fascinating.
Everybody loves Liberty. Everybody loves Liberty.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, the Klan were some Nazis. Of the earliest adopters of the internet. And so it's like when, I don't know, I just like what had all the interviews are blurring together, although this one will be memorable because you guys are amazing. But like, you know, people have been like, oh, like how can like tech companies combat this or like what's their role? And I'm like, the Klan was on the fucking internet in 1982. Like, the Klan has been around on the internet way longer than this group has. Like, it's not like this problem of like organized hate using the internet was impossible to anticipate. It would just have taken 3 seconds of thinking. And unfortunately,
it grew up
these
with
tech companies
internet.
Are like very happy to admit that none of us are worth 3 seconds of thought to them. That like our lives are not worth that.
Our data like, is though.
Yeah, we're cattle for data, and like you'd think they'd want at least our grain to be like a little less poisoned, but no. So
speaking of poison, sorry, my brain automatically pivots to ad plugs in times like this.
Yeah,
I apologize.
Speaking of poisoned grain, you know it won't sell you poisoned grain.
Oh, no, actually, we're entirely supported by the poisoned grain
industry. By the poisoned grain industry.
Yeah.
We're all
I
in.
Made that call a while ago. There's less money in it than you might think, actually.
Yeah. It's
grain
disappointing.
Dion.
Not a lot of takers, unfortunately. Yeah. But
we aren't making money on this show.
No, it's actually been a disaster. but one of these days, one of these... I was going to finish the joke by making like a Salem Witch Trials joke about all of that. Ergot, that was the name of the poisoning. Anyway.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Ergot.
It wasn't, didn't wind up being a joke, but you can see where I was going to go there.
Ergot milk?
Ergot. Yeah. Oh, damn it. That's a good ad. Ergot milk. And then people start hallucinating and accusing each other of being witches.
I
love this idea.
Oh, my God.
This sounds so much healthier than QAnon.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, like, if there was a mass outbreak of ergot poisoning in the U.S. in 2020, how would you tell?
Right.
Things are already so fucking nuts. Like,
it's everybody's nicer
already.
Now.
Yeah.
Welcome to the worst year ever. We'll get through it together or not. Everything is so dumb, 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 dumb.
I didn't write a ton about QAnon. Write a big feature about it for the New Republic like last week, and like just like reading about like the mole children and the like 35,000 kids like sexually abused in tunnels and having their blood drunk by the elite under Central Park. And then I like went for a walk in Central Park and was like, where are the mole children
tunnels? Where are they hiding? Yeah.
Where are they hiding? And I did not see anything. I saw some burdock. I saw leaves turning. I saw a lot of runners. I am suspicious of joggers because they seem too healthy to me, but I didn't see any. I didn't see any. I didn't see any tunnels. Mole children, mole kids. It's a wild time, and I think the pandemic has certainly accelerated QAnon.
Oh,
and
God,
I think
yeah.
accelerated a lot of these fringe ideologies because, like, even the most grounded and sane people I know are just like feeling confused and feeling scared, and like the information coming at us like is a lot of it is dubious, and like life is quite substantially disrupted for a lot of people. And like, so it does make sense to me that people are finding comfort in the arms of conspiracy, which is always full of certainty. Like my feeling is like anyone selling you too great a degree of certainty is suspect.
Oh yeah. I mean, plus people just have so much more time in general sitting in their anxiety and our mental health.
Yeah. And like, isolation is going to breed that too. Like, we're isolated. That's how you get people into cults, is by isolating them from their world and their support systems.
As a musician I quite admire said in a song, be suspicious of simple answers. That shit's for fascists and fucking teenagers.
Yeah, man. And I, that's why I always speak in paragraphs to make sure that everyone knows I'm not a fascist. No, I think, I had a jump on this by already being like an agoraphobe with a panic disorder. So like
you were
anxiety
prepared.
And isolation ain't
great
nothing new on me.
Thing to have going into 2020. You really nailed it there.
Yeah. I will say that like the major difference this book made in my lifestyle, like doing this level of sort of vitriol immersion, was that I started collecting swords. Like, I just, like...
That's a good thing to do.
Yeah. I wanted to bring that up because I feel like you and Robert Cabond.
Swords. Yeah, I have... So
the
I
rich
have...
person's machete.
fancy machete.
Well, honestly, I mean, if you go to, like, museumreplicas.com, they have some deals. And, like, it's not, like... It's, like, you know, if I... Like, every time I got, like, a payment on my book installment, an installment of my book advance, I would, like... buy a sword. So I have like two broadswords, a saber, and a dagger, and a sword cane. So
a sword cane.
You're set.
Yeah,
that's
the cane is a little knife at the end. What is the sword cane?
Yeah, I'll show it to you. Hang on. So at first, it just looks like I'm ready to go play Baccarat with Lord Winstanley Greville Pipe.
And how is Lord Winstanley Greville Pipe doing these days, by the way?
Oh, charming. He's always quite charming, and his hounds are very well behaved. But then, should someone approach me in Lord Winstanley Greville Pipe with nefarious motive? Well.
Oh! That's a goddamn sword.
I just pulled out a pretty. Pretty pointy ass stiletto. This is very effective in an audio medium, but just imagine that.
I love to see it though.
Podcast listeners love props. They like prop comedy.
They love to
I'm
hear
the
us
Gallagher
see
of podcasts. But no, imagine that I just pulled a stiletto out of a rather lovely bone handled cane.
And imagine all of our faces doing like a fun grin when she did.
I want Carrot Top to have a podcast so bad and just do all of his prop comedy on the podcast.
And describe his prop comedy. Yeah, not actually exactly. Do it. Just say, if I were in front of you right now, I would be pulling out a rubber chicken. And
I'd make this out of this, and I'd take these two things and put them together.
Yeah, it's the only thing I'd listen to. I would shut down all of our podcasts so that there would be more listening time for Carrot Top describing
Robert.
His gags. Sophie, this is more important than us. This
no
is
more
about
podcasts.
Carrot Top.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean,
describing what he would do on stage.
I have a podcast too. Actually, it was funny. I was like very nervous. I had the book launch last night, and I was telling a friend I was nervous, and you know, she's like, "Well, you can always say
I'm an author, not a podcaster. And I'm like, but I have a podcast.
You have a podcast. Plug your podcast.
The podcast is called, it's called Moby Dick Energy. And it's a chapter by chapter breakdown of the book Moby Dick.
Oh my God.
So every week I get to spend an hour or two talking about Herman Melville and just completely ignoring, like being like, I'm an 1851 baby on the Pequod.
That sounds like self-care to me.
It is like a weirdly important element of my self-care. It's just like spending one, like, you know, a while a week, like talking to someone smart and like doing a deep dive into just like how fucking weird Herman Melville is. The one overlap was this chapter, The Whiteness of the Whale, which basically argues that whiteness is really sinister and full of malevolent intent. And I'm like, I couldn't agree more.
This is very on brand for you right now.
Before I dropped out of college to pursue a career of damaging my brain with drugs, I had a creative writing teacher who insisted that the book Moby Dick had the answers to all of life's questions in it. And I go back and forth every year as to whether or not he was a crank or absolutely right. I'm leaning more in the right direction.
He was a crank who was absolutely right.
Yeah, both can be true.
A wonderfully weird book. And I would recommend that you should read my book, Culture Warlords, and then read Moby Dick, because since almost no one has read it yet, because it just came out today, I can be like, it's actually the heir in Western literature to Herman Melville, and,
and no one will
sit on
it.
A carrot. Ernest Hemingway. This is truly the new wave of literature in the West.
Side note: will you send me a link so I can put it in our episode description?
Oh, to
your book.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Like I said up top, incredibly well written. I'm really excited to
we'll link it in our episode description, guys.
Yeah, but can you tell people where they can find it?
Is it so? The good news is everywhere. As of today, it's on Amazon. It's on if you want to support your local bookstore, there's bookshop.org, where you can order through your local bookstore or just call up your local bookstore if you don't have cash for a brand new book purchase. You can call your local library and ask them to have it. And it's also on Audible, where if you liked my voice, you can hear it for 8 hours because I narrated the audiobook.
That's so cool.
Yeah, that took a long time and like involved me just like saying the like like learning how to pronounce a lot of German.
Because of
the subject matter. I don't recommend doing that. I
feel like it's all more tedious than you'd expect reading your own book. And you're like, oh, this is hard.
Well, it's just like it's like putting it under like the most intense microscope possible.
Yeah.
And you're just like, oh God, every flaw, and I can't change a word. But like,
it's too late to change it.
Yeah, but it's out everywhere. Books are sold, and really, just like Ernest Hemingway found shaking in his grave. T.S. Eliot was an anti-Semite anyway, so fuck him. But you know. He is truly in a wasteland of envy at how amazing my book is. So that's my pitch. You won't be disappointed. How good you be with
It's the Moby Dick pitch. Of racists.
Yeah.
Not that the book is. You know what I'm saying.
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm pursuing the white whale of white supremacy to stab it to death with my harpoon of truth.
With your...
Or your cane sword.
Sword cane. Yeah.
Sword cane of truth.
We brought it back around. Tell our listeners where they can check you out online.
Oh, yeah. So I'm on Twitter. That's like my main jazz. You're better off just searching my name, Talia Laven, T-A-L-I-A-L-A-V-I-N. My handle is Trick in Kiev, which is a pun on Chicken Kiev, the dish. And I made while I was living in Kiev for a year. And is really stupid, but I can't change it. Otherwise, I'll lose my blue check and then I'll die.
I like it. I think it's cute.
It's my blue check is a horcrux of mine. I cannot lose it.
I know.
But yeah, so Chicken Kiev, you can find me on Twitter, and I'm on Instagram as Talia Inter Alia, which is like Talia among other things in Latin, because I'm a big freaking dork. And and Moby Dick Energy comes out almost every week if you're into deep dives on deep dives into whaling. thank you so much for having me, you guys.
Thank you so
much for being here. Listeners, check out Talia's book and podcast. And as she just urged you to do, go out into the ocean and gun down a whale.
Yep.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, probably don't, but you can admire the whale and experience the majesty and terror of the sea.
Yeah.
One thing that I do, no, sorry. I started as like a means of self-care during like most intense Nazi immersion times. The Nantucket Historical Association has these whaling logs that you can like help transcribe. And I started doing that.
How soothing.
It was so soothing. Like it was just like weather today continues fine. Like saw a school of flying fish off the starboard bow. And I just like kept, yeah. And that I learned to decipher 18th century handwriting. So on that note, thank you guys so much for having me on.
Thank you again. And you guys can check us out online at Worst Year Pod on Instagram, Twitter, etc. You know this. You guys know this. All right. Thanks again, Talia.
Bye.
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 Everything's so dumb. Everything's so dumb.
I tried. Yes. Daniel?
Lovely.
Worst Year Ever is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.